been almost 2 years since the fight against the dreaded coronavirus began. Countries around the world have risen to the challenge and launched an impressive, unprecedented campaign, throwing everything in the kitchen sink at this generation-defining pandemic. Vaccines were rolled out at warp speed, contact tracing was turbocharged with digital technology, and rapid testing was enabled by advances in science. Yet here we are in Singapore, staring down a new record of infections, and the government ramping up testing and saying we can't rule out a circuit breaker or a return to phase 2 heightened alert. Why this change in posture? Will Singapore ever see a clean, clear exit strategy from the pandemic? And what happened to that vision of living normally with an endemic COVID? It's Wednesday, September 8th, 4:30 p.m. And this is Heart of the Matter. I'm Lin Su Ling. And with me to discuss the latest COVID situation are Lim Po Lian, a member of the Expert Committee for COVID-19 Vaccination.
Hello, Su Ling.
And Wee Eng Yong, professor at the Program in Emerging Infectious Diseases at Duke NUS Medical School.
Hi, everyone.
So, Eng Yong, give me your sense. When you saw 328 cases yesterday, 185 unlinked, amid the school holidays with many young people who can't get vaccinated out and about, how worried are you over these high infection numbers?
Not at all. And the reason for that is some time ago, Minister of Health himself had said this, that actually we're more concerned about the number of cases that end up requiring oxygen and eventually ending up in ICU. And because we have such a high proportion of vaccinated people in Singapore now, even if they do get infected with the virus, the infection has mainly either been asymptomatic or mild. I think we can live with that. We've gone past a stage where we think we can eliminate the virus. So we're going to have to live with this. And this virus and this disease will be around as long as it doesn't cause severe disease and occupy all the beds in the healthcare system, we can manage.
The challenge is also maybe the messaging. So Po Lian, as we open up, I think people understand that more cases will be inevitable. This is something that the multi-ministry task force recognized on Friday with the recent increase, quote unquote, was not unexpected. But I think the challenge was on Monday when MOH had come out to warn that Singapore could see potential exponential rise and quick actions needed. We had to wrap up testing. The ministry urged restraint on social gatherings, and even a circuit breaker was not ruled out by Lawrence Wong, the co-chair of the MTF. So if not infection numbers, what accounts for this somewhat shifting of gears from a somewhat balanced position on Friday to a more reactive, aggressive one on Monday?
It's a little bit of the tapping on the brakes that the minister had talked about before. In a way, we are feeling our way forward. While the primary objective of vaccination is to prevent severe cases and deaths, and also preventing the healthcare system from getting too overwhelmed, at the same time, we do care about the number of infections. Vaccinations have never been a silver bullet. We have always said that we control COVID with a combination of measures, including masks, contact tracing for exposed persons, isolation of infectious cases, and border control measures. So in a way, when we see the rise of cases, we have to sort of tap on the brakes pretty lightly. That's what's being signaled by the call to voluntarily cut back on social interactions, because all of those things make a difference, not just vaccination.
But if you look at the ICU cases, it was still quite low, only 20 over cases requiring oxygen. So why is it that we pulled those brakes? Why is it also because on Monday, we saw 200 over cases, quite similar to Friday as well? What's changed? Why the extreme caution? What dangers are we not seeing here?
For someone to get severely ill, they have to get infected first. So the absolute number of infections, it's not something that we don't care about. We do care about the number of infections, because if you do get infected, then there's always the possibility, especially if you have not been vaccinated. And we know that there are at least 10-15% of the elderly who are not vaccinated, as well as all the children under 12 who are still too young to be vaccinated. And we do care about those cases and infections. In a way, it's a difficult message, because at the one hand, we don't want people to panic. But on the other hand, we would say the number of infections still matters.
One more question before I throw this over to Eng Yong. Even if people get hospitalized, though, aren't we in a stronger position? Because as you mentioned, vaccination rates are high, one of the world's highest, in fact. And even in the op-ed that the co-chairs of the MTF penned, they mentioned antibody, antiviral treatments have been effective in treating the critically ill and reducing mortality. So Singapore was also one of the first countries that approved remdes severe, so we're not defenseless. Why then this messaging of caution, of urging to dial back interactions?
I think because every death is one death too many in some ways. The hard truth is that, you know, every year people die of influenza and dengue, and that's really hard. We don't want anyone to die. But at the same time, the reality of reopening and the reality of COVID becoming endemic is that we will see some deaths, but we're still trying to minimize those cases and deaths as much as possible.
Is that also your view, Eng Yong?
One of the situations that we are finding ourselves in is that this is the first pandemic or outbreak that we are using PCR to diagnose asymptomatic infection. So previously, we just tracked cases. But now, because we have the tools to be able to go and screen and then detect virus very sensitively, so we're picking up a lot. And so part of this 200, 300 that we're seeing now, unfortunately, mixes in this asymptomatic infection, which in the past you would not have seen. So by counting this into the group, now the numbers are a lot bigger. I don't think that's a problem, except that we have to keep that in perspective when we consider what to do. That's one. Two is that I understand what Podian is saying. You start to see the expansion of cases first before you eventually see the severe cases, because that takes a bit of time to develop. I'd like to offer an alternative explanation, given that we have such a big pool of vaccinated people now. The way vaccine works is not to prevent infection. There are very few vaccines that can fully prevent infection. Most vaccines work by preventing disease. So the way it prevents disease is to recall the immune cells that form the memory pool to be able to deal with the virus once we get infected again. That memory recall takes a bit of time. It's just like the analogy that Minister Ong gave a few weeks ago on the idea that the first vaccination is like cramming for an exam. And then after that, when you get re-exposed, it's the memory that you have to recall to be able to deal with the situation. And likewise, that's what happens with the immune system. It's trying to recall this memory. That takes a few days. So now it becomes a race between the virus and the immune system in terms of when the fever starts. So it looks like for Delta, the time taken to cause a fever and illness is about 3 days compared to the original Wuhan strain, which was about 5 days. That's the data that came out from China recently. So whereas I think for the immune cells to be recalled to a level that's enough now to fight the virus takes about 4 days. What happens therefore is that amongst the vaccinated, when infected, you get that breakthrough illness, but they don't progress very far because the memory pool then catches up and then will then tackle the virus. In Holland, when they look for infectious virus in vaccinated who fall ill with COVID, even though they are PCR positive, they cannot find the infectious virus, or at least it's much harder to find infectious virus. In other words, the immune system has now mounted a response to kill the virus. So there's remnant RNA, and so you detect it in a PCR, but you cannot grow the virus, which means it's dead. In that sense, I agree with Polian that, you know, we need to continue to monitor the symptomatic cases because that's your first clue that something could be amiss. But I don't think we need to worry too much when we start to PCR everyone and then find this asymptomatic pool and then start getting nervous. I don't think we need to be nervous. I think we can move forward, albeit cautiously, and not to just open up overnight.
Well, then, since you mentioned that certainly one death is one death too many, what's your answer to people who say that the cost of restrictions are high and our thresholds seem to be low when you compare it to, for example, annual flu deaths, which number about 800 or so a year? And that works out to, I think, 15,000 infections a month during the high season. But then when you look at COVID, of course, backward looking, but there's only been 50 over deaths.
My answer to people who say that COVID is like the flu is that if COVID is like the flu, this would be the 1918 flu pandemic, because the death rate for the 1918 flu is approximately 2%. That's 2 in 100. Whereas seasonal influenza, the death rate is about 1 in 1,000. And if you look at the worldwide numbers for COVID, there are 200 million plus cases and about 4 million deaths. And pretty consistently across many countries, the death rate is about 2%. If you say that this is flu, then this is the 1918 flu. So the challenge is that in regular seasonal influenza, we have immunity because many of us have had the flu or the flu vaccine. Whereas with COVID, This was a new novel pathogen, which meant that no one in the world had really any decent immunity from infection or vaccine against COVID. And now we're vaccinated. But the difficulty is that the deaths come from three things. It's not just the virus itself, how virulent it is, how good it is at killing people, but it's also the person who's being infected. So if you have a 90-year-old that gets it compared to a 20-year-old, they are much more likely to get it. So if you get widespread community infection, then you're more likely to lose a lot more people as opposed to more controlled infection. And then the third thing is mortality in an outbreak depends upon healthcare systems being overwhelmed. If you're in a place where there is not enough oxygen, there aren't enough ICU beds, it's not just the people with COVID who will not get a bed or oxygen. It's actually other people who don't have COVID. You could have a stroke or a heart attack and you need that oxygen or an ICU bed. But, you know, guess what? They're filled with COVID patients. So the death rates will go up, not just for COVID, but also for non-COVID cases. And that is what we're trying to slow down when we try to prevent transmission and infection, as well as severe disease and death.
I just want to move into vaccination because there have been worrying news on vaccination the last couple of days. Mr. Ong Yi Kang talking about how the effectiveness is 40% against infection. And then, of course, NCID Director Liu Yixin proclaiming that vaccination is insufficient against Delta, suggesting that it might be less effective as a tool against COVID if the Delta variant is the primary variant in Singapore. Because we've gotten vaccination rates high, more than 80%, does this mean now that we must shift emphasis towards other parts of endemic living strategy, like the contact tracing or the testing even more?
I don't think so. I understand the worry that COVID can cause excess death and all that. But at the same time, we have to accept that COVID is never going to go away. So either we bite the bullet and say, okay, this is normal. From now on, this is what it is, right? That we will never be able to gather as a family if the family is larger than five. We will never be able to see our friends. We'll never be able to celebrate wedding with all our friends and families. If we are going to have to accept that and say that's the new normal, then I'm not sure that society is quite prepared for that. But at the same time, I think that, yes, there are dangers, but that's the new reality. The vaccines work. They work against Delta very well. And as an immunologist, I would go one step further and argue that actually it's not a bad thing to be asymptomatically infected with Delta when you're vaccinated, right? Because the vaccine only shows you the spike protein of the virus. It doesn't show you the rest of the virus. There is now a lot of evidence that if we've been infected with a human coronavirus in the past and then developed T cells that cross-recognize the SARS-2 virus, such people are protected against COVID-19. In other words, we need to recognize the other parts of the virus so that our immunity against new variants in the future will be a lot more resilient than what we would be if we only have immunity against the spike protein. I think it's actually not a bad thing. Now, that, of course, is theoretical. It's easier to say it than to say implement it, because when you let it loose, then how do you control it? How do you keep it within those people who would mostly get asymptomatic or mild COVID compared to those who might potentially get more severe disease? Although I agree that it's not entirely feasible to just use vaccine, we need to bring in the other components like drugs, right? So there are drugs now that can be given in a primary care setting that you don't actually need to go to the hospital to get drugs. Now, Singapore is slightly different because we quarantine everyone. But in other countries, they treat COVID as outpatients. And there are trials that are now showing that these drugs can be given in the outpatient, like the monoclonal antibody. And of course, there's remdesivir. There are also the disease-modifying drugs like dexamethasone. And recently, another group just completed a trial showing that if you use another drug that blocks one of the key inflammatory response, that also modifies the disease outcome and modulates the disease severity. So I think with all these tools, we will have a chance of living with COVID.
With the spike protein, the question is whether we need to be exposed to, like, say, the inactivated virus and all the different proteins. But Ying Yong, that's also something that's been used very effectively, for example, with hepatitis B vaccine, where a very effective vaccine includes just exposure to the surface antigen, without having to be exposed to the whole virus for hepatitis B. We've got 20, 30 years experience with hepatitis B. There are theoretical advantages to being exposed to the whole virus, but there are other precedents from other vaccines to say that it's actually quite effective and holds the infection at bay, for example, with hepatitis B. Now, a lot of the treatments that are for oral are quite expensive. So monoclonal antibodies can certainly be given in the outpatient setting, but they're still very expensive. And the role for it is not well worked out in terms of whether it works better for post-exposure. And remdesivir is given intravenous, so that's not something that's going to be very readily given. I agree that a lot of COVID, which are mild or asymptomatic, can probably be managed as an outpatient. But if you're sick enough to need some of these treatments, like dexamethasone and you need oxygen, you probably should be monitored in the hospital. And that's what we're trying to preserve the healthcare system for the sickest ones. MOH has already piloted home isolation so that people can recover at home, those who are mildly sick, as long as they don't infect their household members as well. Because, you know, when I see patients, I have a household of four where all four of them are infected, two are vaccinated, two are unvaccinated. So I do think that even when the PCR is positive, many of those vaccinated cases are still infectious. The duration of infection is shorter. And we think that vaccination does reduce infection and transmission. It just doesn't zero it out. We just have to be really careful. We are feeling our way forward. Because when you get infected, you could be lucky and get asymptomatic or mild disease, but you could also end up with long COVID. There's some data, for example, that shows that vaccination halves the risk of long COVID, even if you get infected. So there are real advantages to being vaccinated. But if you're vaccinated and you are sick, you might get it mild, but you might bring it home to your elderly parent who, in spite of being vaccinated, might still be one of those people that are unfortunate enough to get really sick and end up in the ICU or die. It's much, much, much lower, but it's not a zero risk.
The example of hepatitis B is completely way off. I'm sorry, Pauline, it doesn't apply. Okay. Hepatitis B, the incubation period is 30 days or even longer. Mm-hmm. You were talking about a three-day incubation period. That immunologically is completely different. I'm sorry, that example does not apply in this case. And there are plenty, plenty, plenty of vaccines that have just used subunit or just inactivated virus that have completely failed. And dengue has been one of them. SARS and MERS have the other example. RSV, I can go on. But let's not go there. I was talking about T cells. And T cells see the rest of the virus.
Okay. Thank you for that. There's definitely different medical opinions here. But if I can just bring back the conversation to what we were trying to get at, which is vaccination. And I think we all had an expectation that vaccination would move the needle, would be able to transition us in a place where it's more certain we will be able to live without too much restrictions. However, as I mentioned, there's worrying news about the effectiveness of COVID vaccines that Minister Ong Ye Kung had mentioned. Liu Yixin also mentioned that vaccination is insufficient against the Delta variant. So it sounds like the goalpost is shifting. We know that vaccination remains an important critical part of countering COVID. It's a baseline protection. But is vaccination less of the shield than we thought it would be?
It's less of a shield than we thought it would be because of Delta. Delta is only early in the Greek alphabet. So the problem is we're already at mu, which is only a variant of interest, but it's rising to the level of variant of concern. So the goalposts shift partly because the virus itself is changing. And there's also differences in terms of how much transmission is happening. And that's why we have not sort of had a Freedom Day kind of a big bang opening. If you think about last year, where we had absolutely no vaccine, or in the case of SARS, for example, where we were able to bring SARS-CoV-1 under control, when you have an emerging infection where there's no vaccine and no treatment, you actually have to fall back on time-honored outbreak control measures, which is isolation of infectious cases, contact tracing and quarantine of those who are exposed and incubating, who can become infectious, and trying to get a vaccine up, because we've never been able to control any infectious disease without vaccines. Vaccines, as you know, has never been 100%. We've only eradicated smallpox. with a vaccine. Vaccines make a difference. Many of us do not know anyone now currently getting polio, but we certainly know plenty of people in the previous generations who had polio. And the difference that made was by vaccine. When we came up with this in December, we said vaccine is not a silver bullet. We still need to be careful. We still need the masks. We still need all these safe management measures. And Delta keeps shifting that. And then the next thing after Delta may shift it yet again. It's silly to throw away a good intervention like vaccinations just because it's not 100%.
I fully agree. If you recall last year, around this time when we were developing a vaccine, the bar was set at 50%. If we can get a vaccine that works with a 50% efficacy, we were going to be very happy. But when the Pfizer's and Moderna's vaccine came out with 95% efficacy, of course, everyone was saying, wow, this is beyond expectation. But I think that also shifted our expectation to now we expect a 90% efficacy before we say that something is going to be good. So with Delta, as Polian said, you know, it shifted the effectiveness downwards a little bit in terms of the protection against symptomatic infection, even though the effectiveness against severe disease still remain well within in the 90%. The expectation is that perhaps the Delta has changed things. But ultimately, what we want is to prevent that severe disease, as Polian mentioned earlier, right? So, and that is still solidly effective. We could keep going and chasing this, but at some point we have to accept that we're chasing our own tail. We either accept this as normality from now on, or we go back to our normal lives and expect that there will be some severe cases. But that's a decision for the society to make.
Well, then, are you saying that we're not close to endemic living at all?
Well, I think we have to see what's coming. If we look at boosters, for example, boosters will probably help us get closer to that, certainly in terms of protecting further those who are most vulnerable. So if you think about vaccine effectiveness, there are four factors that get into it. There is the vaccine type, say mRNA versus inactivated versus subunit. There is also the virus variant, secondly. Delta changed everything. It was a real game changer.
But how did it fall so much from 69% estimated by the NCID a few months ago to 40%?
No. We're talking about different outcomes. When we talk about preventing infection, that's different from preventing symptomatic disease versus death. I mean, that's true even for things like chickenpox. Chickenpox is a common vaccine. It's 90% effective against preventing symptomatic chickenpox, but it's like 98%, 99% effective against preventing death from chickenpox or severe complications like brain infection and lung infection.
But the same figure for the prevention of infection is much higher in other countries.
Yes.
It's the same metric that we're looking at.
Yeah, so that's one of the challenges when you look at different types of studies. So I believe that data was quoted from a household contact study. But when you're looking at some of the data that's quoted from other countries, sometimes it's comparing apples with oranges when you're just pulling these numbers and saying, oh, it's 40% or 69% or 76% vaccine effectiveness. Because you have to look at what the context is, whether it's a household setting or whether it's an airline transmission or whether it's in a hospital transmission or just population-wide. So those are really very different. The third factor in terms of vaccine effectiveness is actually the vaccine recipient, whether someone is elderly, whether someone's immunocompromised, etc. And then the fourth variable, whether the vaccine is effective, is the time since vaccination. Because we know that for different vaccines and different diseases, you may need a booster. So like typhoid vaccine, you may need a booster in 3 years. Tetanus is 10 years. Flu is every 6 to 12 months. If you think about it, it's amazing. We've only had COVID for about a year and a half. So we're trying to make a decision based upon, this is real science happening in real time. So we're trying to figure out the time since vaccination, how much that makes a difference for someone, for example, who's 80 years old versus someone who's 50 years old or 20 years old. The recommendations about boosters and trying to protect people will depend upon age and the vaccine recipient's immune status, etc. But that's the other variable, is the time since vaccination. And even the duration between vaccine doses makes a difference.
And Yong, just throwing this to you, we know that vaccination is not a silver bullet. We've been warned about this since last year. And we know it's not a license to break rules or expect that there'll be no restrictions whatsoever. But people did expect a lot more certainty with the COVID situation. with these levels of vaccination, though. So when you look at what was announced on Monday, were you surprised? Or just like Poland, did you expect that we would be more conservative and take this approach?
I have to say I was surprised. At the same time, I'm not privy to all the discussions with MOH. So from a public point of view, reading the news in Singapore, yes, I was surprised. It's a societal decision, right? How much are we willing to accept of the current measures as well as the price of not continuing the current measures? I mean, you look at the UK, when the government decided to open up and have Freedom Day, there were those who rejoiced, there were those who were afraid, and there were those who commented that it was irresponsible to open up so early, and then there were those that said that other parts of life need to go on. The scenario is still unfolding. So far, so good, I guess, in the UK, that the cases went up as expected, but not as bad as some had anticipated. So I guess at some point, Singapore will have to make that hard decision as well. This thing is not going to go away. If you delay another few more months before you start to think about scaling down on phase two and then start to open up a little bit more, then, as Bodian said, you'll probably coincide at the point where we probably have to start thinking about boosting. Then do we hold back opening up until we boost the elderly population? What happens after we finish boosting the elderly population and then say, okay, now the children now needs to be boosted? This will go on. And I think Bodian was right that this is science in motion, and we probably will have to be very nimble. The hard decision as to what do we do moving forward, at least in the coming few weeks and months, it is a societal decision. It's what we are willing to accept as a society.
You mentioned the need to retain a high level of vigilance. I just want to ask if the overall role of testing in endemic living has changed for you. Because a couple of months back, they said it was less a tool for ring fencing and quarantine people exposed to infected persons, and more to ensure discrete events and trips can take place safely. But on Monday, we've heard that we've got to move towards aggressive contact tracing, ring fencing of clusters, and pushing for more pervasive testing.
With all infectious diseases, if you can detect people who are infectious, so what we've done is move towards easier and more accessible testing, like the antigen rapid test, the so-called fast and easy testing, and the more precise PCR testing. If you find someone who is infectious and they know that they're infected, then they can protect others around them by restricting their movements, not infecting other people knowingly. But by testing, you actually confirm that you are infected, and then you take yourself out of circulation to recover. So I think in that sense, it makes sense to keep doing it, because we're still trying to, in a sense, lower the number of bullets ricocheting around the room. If you sort of stand back and look at the big picture relative to many of the countries around us, as well as around the world, we are in many ways in a good place. We've only lost 55 people or so, thereabouts, to COVID, and our numbers are still under 70,000. If you actually look at the waves, you know, over the last 12 months, when you look at where other countries have been hit by second, third, and fourth waves, the approach that we've taken after we got hit by that first wave in April, May 2020 that led to the circuit breaker, that would validate the approach that we've taken. It is very cautious, but it is also trying to reopen, like, for example, vaccinated travel lanes, etc. The difficulty with this is that, you know, if you make a mistake and you open up too quickly and lots of people get infected, there is also a pushback to that. Other countries would potentially not want to have us visit them either. So it's a little bit of a challenge, because everyone wants this, right, around the world. And many other countries are in more dire situations. So I would say that the testing and reducing transmission is an approach that has made a difference in keeping a lot of people safe and a lot of people alive that would otherwise have died. We're just going to have to keep figuring our way out, because this is unprecedented. There's still a few curveballs in this pandemic to come. We're less than 2 years into this, and this will be a real challenge moving forward.
Well, then, when we do get to endemic living, is pervasive testing the new normal? Pervasive testing in workplaces, like when we saw the government urging for employers to make regular testing the norm in distributed ART tests? Or is this just part of that transition?
We don't know. There's a short answer. My gut feeling is, if you were to sort of, again, make that analogy to flu, if the virulence eventually drops, to a level of influenza with the help of vaccinations, then what happens when you have the flu? You go and get tested. You might take an oral antiviral like oseltamivir, and you would put on a mask and try to stay home and not give flu to all your workmates. That probably will be where we land with endemic, but with testing and with treatment and with self-isolation. The problem is that a lot of countries are 5%, 10% vaccinated. And when there's a lot of viral replication, there is still the ability for the virus to mutate. And we could still get hit with something beyond Delta.
But not in Singapore, though.
Well, whatever happens elsewhere eventually ends up in Singapore because we are pretty open.
What's your take, Eng Eong? Do you see pervasive testing as part of the necessary backdrop that's always there? My question also is, how do you square off with the messaging to businesses just last week that workers almost had a choice? You can get vaccinated or get tested regularly for select sectors.
Yeah.
But now it sounds like everybody has got to test if you're back in the workplace.
In an endemic situation, we would test suspected cases for the virus. But we won't be screening asymptomatic people. I mean, it's the same way that we're managing dengue. We don't go and screen everyone for asymptomatic dengue infection, even though they are probably a better source to infect the mosquito to transmit to someone else. It's an eventual thing that we probably have to scale ourselves into and accept that we're only going to go after cases. We're not going to go after those who are well and start to look for a virus in that population. But then that's to accept that the virus is endemic. As for whether would a new variant emerge that is going to be fitter than Delta, it is always possible. But Delta is very fit. Everything that's come out so far has been suppressed by Delta. Even if there is a new variant, it's hard to see it being fitter than Delta. I may be wrong, but it's hard to see it. It may be less fit, but when you get it, you get more severe disease. Like to me, if you ask me which one I'm most concerned with, I'm most concerned with Beta, not Delta. But we'll see. Fortunately, Beta is not that fit.
But how do you both square off the idea that when it's endemic, surely you'll be able to, like fever, take your own temperature and see if you need to take further action? With COVID, you'll be able to self-test yourself, right? As part of social responsibility that's being urged.
Having to test those who are with fever for COVID is not so much to isolate or anything. I think there is a need to know when you start to have an increase in cases, because that's going to shape when you're going to boost the population. So the testing and all that is part of surveillance so that you get a good baseline and you get a good trend so that when you see the line creeping upwards beyond what you would expect from a normal fluctuation, that's when you need to start boosting the population. So it's actually more in that context than trying to minimize spread. Eventually, we'll get to that level of vaccination rate that we probably can live with this. We're not going to eliminate it, but we can live with it.
But the complication for people who should be urged to see the doctor is twofold. The NCID survey that shows only half of Singaporeans will do that if they have symptoms. And on the flip side also, vaccination complicates that, right? Because most cases are asymptomatic. People might not even realize, and the thought of getting tested might not even occur to people, right?
So you shouldn't test the asymptomatic population.
Is that your take as well, Pauline?
Well, I think that it is a transition period. What we're doing is trying to buy time. I think in the fully endemic stage, I agree with Eng Yong that we should test those who are symptomatic, and it might even be a self-test and self-isolate. Just like if you think you have the flu or a cold, you should stay home, right? And isolate yourself from your family as well so that the whole family doesn't come down with a cold or a flu. Assuming that everyone is vaccinated, and so then the likelihood of them getting severe disease is much, much, much lower. In the interim, where we're still learning about this disease, for example, the fact that asymptomatic people can still be infectious, that makes a difference because, you know, you could be next to your colleague at work who could be 2 months pregnant and not even realize it or may not be showing, right? So if you didn't know you had infection, in certain situations where you are working very closely together or in a high-risk setting, for example, healthcare institutions, etc., or where being infected affects your operations, then it does sort of make sense, but in the transition period to endemic, we can't sort of jump prematurely to endemic because the rest of the world is still getting there as well. We are going to have to do this a little bit by modeling and trial and error and seeing what's happening in other countries and saying, you know, do we want to go that way? or is that cost too high? So, for example, the fact that places like the US have gone up to more than 100,000 cases, some of the ICUs quite full, certainly in places where the vaccination rates have been lower. Is that something that we want to emulate? Because we have pockets of our population where vaccination rates are much lower. For example, the children. Or if you had a pocket of older people who are unvaccinated, we still have about 90,000 elderly persons who are not vaccinated at all. And if it were to get into that situation or setting, we might find ourselves with a small surge that would have quite a high human impact.
We won't be able to vaccinate everyone. I mean, that's the reality. There will be a population that would refuse. I agree that children, it would be great at the day when the trial is completed, that we can have the vaccine licensed for use in children. I'm looking forward to that day as well. Although already in the UK, there's a debate as to whether it's any benefit to vaccinate children. But I think in any society, to reach 100% is probably not possible. And at some point, we're going to have to accept that we've done our best and we need to get on with our lives.
Let's shift to talk about contact tracing. Ing Yong, when you saw what transpired on Monday when Lawrence Wong talked about the need to do aggressive contact tracing and ring fencing of clusters, did it appear to you like there was a shift in position? Because they had mentioned previously also that eventually we should move towards a situation there where there's no need to conduct massive contact tracing and quarantine.
Yeah, I accept that, as Pauline said, right? We're in the transition phase. We have not phased out contact tracing to phase back in again. I think that never happened. They've always been in operation. That kind of taking a step forward and maybe take a half a step back is not unusual. We're dealing with a situation where we've never been in before, and we have to respond to the data. The general direction, insofar as what we can do, given our vaccination rate and our coverage and what we know about the vaccine, is that I think we can keep in the same direction of moving forward. Of course, the speed and how far and how much really would depend on decisions that we probably have to take as a society.
So, Pauline, the role of contact tracing in endemic living, is active contact tracing always in the background or only activated when the situation gets bad?
That will be a public health decision. We've been talking about the hammer and dance. And I think the dance is two steps forward, one step back. And then, you know, but if you do two steps forward or three steps forward, one step back, you're still moving forward. So I think that's the hammer and dance situation, whether you call it a cha-cha or a foxtrot or whatever.
I just want to move into talking about open and shut restrictions. People do understand that might be a necessary thing if infection rates and hospital beds get overwhelmed. And it's also prioritized definitely over blunt approaches like the circuit breaker or even a wholesale phase 2 heightened alert. But people do feel that it's still pretty economically painful. So does endemic living mean there will be no open and shut targeted restrictions?
The simplest is to look at how we deal with diseases like dengue, influenza. Perhaps not so much the seasonal influenza, but in the same vein as when the 2009 H1N1 pandemic arose and hit Singapore. We also had to respond to these things in terms of the number of cases and all that. Now, I think we can move forward, but of course, the big question is that how long can we keep at this before we may have to scale back a bit to buy time for the booster dose? And that's something that may have to happen in the future. I don't think it has to happen now, but that's something that we may have to do in the future. So for instance, 2 years from now, either a new variant emerges or at the time that really the immunity has waned and that we need to boost. And guess what? The whole world is going to be boosting at the same time because many countries all started at the same time. So there's going to be this queue for vaccine and then we're having to vaccinate our population as rapidly as possible. And then at the same time, ensuring that the rest of the world are equally boosted. That may happen. And until that happens, there may have to be some scale back in terms of our way of life. And maybe we have to go back to some level of restrictions. That may have to happen. It's a very fluid situation and we are responding to the data as it comes.
I see it more as buying time, not just for our population to get vaccinated, but for the rest of the world to get vaccinated. Because I really do think we're not all safe until everyone is safe. The truth is people do travel and you can see someone who has traveled from the risk area. It might feel like Mu is in Colombia and it's right now a variant of interest, but if it did become a variant of concern, Colombia feels a very long ways away, but I can tell you that we do have travel from Colombia. We are an open economy. So in a way, some of these restrictions and safe management measures is not just buying time for our vaccination rates to go up, for the companies to develop a variant-specific vaccine, for us to get boosted. I mean, look at how long it's taken us to vaccinate 8 million, 9 million doses of vaccine. It's unprecedented to try to vaccinate, you know, 10 million doses in 1 year. It's been a Herculean effort, and lots of countries are still struggling with that, you know, 5%, 10% vaccinated. But we're also buying time for the rest of the world to get vaccinated, for us to eventually become safe, because we are open, we are not going to shut down. There is a certain argument to be made for human solidarity. We cannot just, you know, just look after yourself only. We have to care about other countries, our neighbors, other people in the world. And that's why I think it's really important for vaccination and the supply chains to be strengthened, not just for us, but for our neighbors and for countries around the world.
Businesses here need certainty to make plans. So when you think about the potential for restrictions to come down, what should they be looking at in anticipating whether such curbs might be on the cards?
With this pandemic, it's been very hard for those of us who are control freaks, right? I have no idea what my schedule is going to be in a week or 2 weeks. And so it's very hard for businesses to know how to plan when we don't know what the situation is going to be 2 months from now or 2 weeks from now or 2 years from now. There are times where the world goes into a greater flux, right? And there will be times of great flux and uncertainty in the world, and this is one of them. The fact that we want control, we want to know what we're doing in 2 months, we want to know whether we can plan that holiday in December, it's not always possible. And trying to force certainty where there is no certainty to be had. And this is one of those times where there's a lot of variables. It's like playing, you know, 5-10 dimensional chess. The virus is changing. The vaccines are changing. Countries are changing. Epidemiology is changing. So one of the things we have to say in public health is how to be honest with what we know and what we don't know. And if we give certainty and promises that we are not based on reality, then we do everyone a disservice. So this is one of those times where we have to say, we don't know. We will take it one step at a time, 1 month at a time, and we will do the best we can. Everyone wants to reopen. Everyone wants to go back to normal. But we have to get there safely. If it's two steps forward, one step back, that's what it takes.
You're reminding me also that managing expectations is part of that. So, Ing Yong, Lawrence Wong did say that they're looking at the rate at which the virus is spreading, the reproduction rate, or R. But if Delta's natural R is 5 to 8 or 9, and we want to reduce it further from Singapore's current 1.45, does it mean that restrictions like caps on dining out, mask wearing, these today will be permanent fixtures in endemic living?
I wish I could answer that properly, but I can't because I don't know what the true number of cases actually is. The reporting mixes the symptomatic with the asymptomatic. The concept of R is built on the idea of symptomatic, one case passed on to two cases, right? So these are disease, not asymptomatic infection. Because if you count asymptomatic infection, the book goes out the window. There's no science to this. So I can't really answer that question because I have actually not seen the data. The idea of, you know, trying to keep the R below 1.5, is it below 1.2? To me, at some point, is what the society is willing to tolerate. It's not going to be below one. It's not going to disappear. We might be able to get rid of it transiently in Singapore, but it will come back because we can't live as an, you know, by closing our borders. We're going to have to open up at some point. At the end of the day, this is a decision that has to be taken at a societal level. Public health cannot answer that question.
From my public health sort of angle, I would say that the reproductive number, R0 is the base number, which is, say, 5, right? So if one person infects five, it actually doesn't matter in Yong whether it's symptomatic or asymptomatic.
Sorry, the concept was built on disease. It was not built on asymptomatic infection. Because if you apply asymptomatic infection, we're all in trouble for polio because we're now using the inactivated vaccine. The inactivated vaccine will not stop virus transmission. It's just stopping disease. This doesn't apply. I mean, if we want to be correct theoretically. Now, how you apply that eventually is a decision that's going to be taken at a political level, at a societal level, and all that. But I'm sorry, this is a science question, and I'm going to answer it to you as a scientist. I cannot answer that question without seeing the data. We cannot equate asymptomatic infection into this population because then R is no longer equal to one.
So, In Yong, I'm going to beg to disagree. With R, if you have one person infecting five, and then each of those five infecting another five, if you have a secondary sort of transmission period of, say, 3 to 5 days, let's just say for argument's sake, it's four. So in 4 days, one becomes five. In another 4 days, five becomes 25. Then you clearly have a situation where things are almost exponentially increasing, right? 25 becomes 125. But if you put that person into isolation, it's what we call a base reproductive number. So if that person goes into isolation or chooses not to have dinner with 10 people, because that's how you get super spreading events, you know, one person can infect 10 people, right? Or 40 people, as we saw in SARS. The reproductive number, Suling, is something that can be impacted by the measures that we are doing. When we prevent disease with vaccination, I'm going to agree with In Yong that, you know, people who are symptomatic are much more likely to transmit because if they're coughing and sneezing, it makes a difference. But we certainly have seen asymptomatic transmission. And in that situation, by putting them into self-isolation or isolation, or quarantining someone because they are pre-symptomatically transmitting, even before they have a cough. Say they get a cough on Saturday, but they saw like 10 people for dinner on Friday where they were already infectious, then you've immediately got a situation where 10 people are exposed.
The biggest change to R has been vaccination.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's the one factor that has reduced R the most. Yeah, I mean, I agree with Polian that if you want to keep, you know, people isolated and all that, you can reduce R further, but it's coming at a cost to society.
Yes.
Therefore, that's why I say that at some point, society has to accept whether they're willing to pay this cost or they're willing to accept others.
There are infections for which we had no vaccines. I mean, the Ebola vaccine did not exist for the first, you know, 30 years. And we were still able to terminate it because if you can drop R naught, the reproductive number less than one, the outbreak will fizzle out. And you can do that even without vaccines. But in something that's a respiratory infection like this, with potentially pre-symptomatic and asymptomatic transmission, it's much harder, almost impossible to control without vaccination. But with SARS, for example, where we don't seem to have seen that much pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic transmission, we were able to stop SARS with just public health measures. COVID is not SARS. COVID is not flu. And here we need a combination of both, and that's what makes it so difficult.
I just want to round off the podcast already. I know we've talked a lot about the different interventions, and it's clear to us that when in the transition stage. But the thing is, Singapore has always expected cases to rise with restrictions. And that's probably the reason why our reopening has been so slow and careful, despite vaccination rates being high. But do you think it's clear to people why we seem to be having trouble exiting the pandemic? I mean, do you think that perhaps actually endemic living is much further away than the depression we had maybe a couple of months ago?
If you ask that question to 10 people, you'll get 10 different answers. Depends on our tolerance, right? And what we see as the balance between cost and benefit of what we're doing. If you ask me, I think we should be opening up.
Polian, parting shots?
I would say that the pandemic is still going on in the rest of the world. We are sort of sometimes between waves. So it's always premature to declare victory. I think it's time to move on. It's a little bit like, you know, rain in Singapore, right? You can sometimes have one part of Singapore that right now it's blue skies and other parts of Singapore where it's raining hard.
And,
we live in a world, right, where it's raining really hard on the neighbors around us. And we have a little patch of clearing sky, but I don't think we have exited this yet while there are fires burning around us. if we do this and we open up, we have to do it very carefully.
Of course, in stages. I'm not saying we go Freedom Day to stages. Yeah.
So I think we need to sort of, you know, begin to try to approximate endemic living, but it's going to be a lot of stepping forward and stepping back because we're not there yet.
Ho Lien, Eng Yong, thank you very much for being here. And there you have it. What's behind Singapore's cautious approach towards COVID and the recent announced ramping up of testing and other measures? Now, if you don't want to miss an episode of Heart of the Matter, remember to subscribe on MeListen, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your fix. And if you want sharp insights like what you've heard today, sign up for CNA's weekly commentary newsletter on cna.asia. This has been Heart of the Matter with me, Lin Su Ling, Crispina Robert, our podcast editor, and Erin Low, our research writer. Signing off until next week.